Hi everyone and welcome back to Clinical Conversations, Ambulance Victoria's clinical podcast. Shock is the quintessential critical illness. It's core business for all clinicians working in pre-hospital and critical care. But do we really understand it and could we be doing better for these patients? In this episode, I'll speak with David about shock and the new approach to undifferentiated shock at AV. So stick around for a shocker of an episode. I'm James Oswald, Clinical Practice Development Specialist and Paramedic with Ambulance Victoria.
And I'm David Anderson, Ambulance Victoria Medical Director.
Well, David, usually we'd seek out an expert on our topic to come on the show, but when we were talking about who might be able to speak to it, there were a few better people than yourself. You're an intensivist, so it's fair to say you're probably pretty familiar with shock. Is that right?
That's right, James. The assessment and management of shock is bread and butter intensive care medicine. Other than respiratory failure, it's probably the most common condition that we deal with. And it's really, you know, intensive care is quite a general specialty, I would say. But there's one or two areas that we have expertise in that other specialists don't. And shock would definitely be one of those. And look, it's probably best for you and the listeners that we didn't invite another intensivist on to talk about shock, because the podcast would have just deteriorated into that intensivist and I having long-winded and pointless arguments about definitions and so on.
Great. So the perfect person to speak to. I think the best place to start is probably to jump straight into Ambulance Victoria's new approach. We recently released a new guideline for undifferentiated shock or causes of shock that aren't clearly pathology specific, for which there isn't a different guideline. Anaphylaxis and hemorrhagic shock, for example, they'll always have their own approach. But this guideline is more general, and it's likely that it'll represent the first step towards managing shock in a more consistent way across different guidelines and perhaps more consistently with how things are done in hospital. For our listeners who are not familiar with the guideline, it's pretty simple. It starts off with normal saline, 1 to 2 liters or thereabouts, metaraminol, noradrenaline, and then finally, if those things haven't worked, adrenaline infusions are also available. We'll get stuck into the management at the moment, before we get ahead of ourselves, David, what is shock and why is it bad?
What a great question. What is shock? I mean, I guess the first thing to highlight, you know, for people who spend a bit of time thinking about it, is that shock has a very weird name. And, you know, when you often see media reports saying that, you know, there was a traumatic incident and a number of patients were assessed and managed for shock and then left at the scene, that's obviously not the case, and that's referring to emotional distress. So I guess what we're talking about today is circulatory shock, which is a condition associated with essentially, you know, in the broadest terms, an imbalance of supply and demand of oxygen to the tissues. The origin of the term is unclear, and it probably derives from the French word shock, which essentially means an unexpected blow or impact. And so the probable etymology is that, you know, someone's hit by a cannonball, and because the term was first described in the 1700s, and then develops what we now know as circulatory shock as a fairly predictable outcome of having a cannonball shoot through you. What happens in shock is different for each classification of shock, but at the cellular level, broadly similar. What's happening is that for some reason, there's inadequate blood flow to a mass of tissues in the body, and that inadequate blood flow impairs the ability of cells to do what cells do. So there's an inability of the circulation to supply oxygen, to supply nutrition, and there ends up being, in many cases, a switch from aerobic to anaerobic metabolism, a buildup of various waste products, which although in and of themselves aren't particularly harmful, they can have effects on the blood, such as acidifying the blood, and that then, you know, goes on to cause its own after effects. And we used to describe, we don't as much now, but we used to describe stages of shock moving from reversible to progressive through to irreversible. That still stands to a degree, although it's not, as with many things in healthcare, it's not as clear cut as when it was perhaps first described in the 1960s. Some important things to think about is that the classical description of shock is, I suppose, probably best exemplified by hypovolemic shock, And this was, you know, classically described as in, you know, traumatic blood loss or during the cholera era, you know, losing liters and liters of fluid through gastrointestinal losses. So you have less blood volume than before. You have vasoconstriction as a response. That combination of low blood volume, vasoconstriction, means that there's less blood flowing through the tissues, and shock results from that. And classically, that's associated with tachycardia, hypotension, and cool peripheries. The most common type of shock that we probably see these days in a high-income country is shock associated with sepsis, so septic shock. And that's totally different. There's no change in blood volume. There's a little bit of fluid loss from capillary leak. But what there is widespread vasodilation as part of the inflammatory response to sepsis. And so that then affects blood flow and ends up eventually affecting blood pressure and causing the tachycardia and the other signs. But that's usually associated with warm peripheries. The reason I mention this is that the important thing is flow. And a little bit of a point that I often try to make to registrars, for example, is that we measure blood pressure because we can. What we actually are interested in is blood flow. If the blood flow is adequate, probably doesn't matter what the blood pressure is, but the two of them often go together. And in some states, there can be, you know, very high, like in sepsis, there can be a very high cardiac output, but still inadequate blood flow to the tissues that need it because of widespread vasodilation. And as I'm sure many of you will be aware, in children and in young adults and adolescents, pressure is maintained often at the expense of flow for a very, very long time. And so blood pressure alone isn't the best indicator. Shock is a you know, a clinical diagnosis based on a number of findings and sometimes based on experience. You know, the there's a classical definition that I'm sure all paramedics will remember of, let me see if I can remember it, widespread inadequate perfusion at the cellular level or something like that from some textbook somewhere. And that I guess, suppose that kind of does sum up. But essentially, it's some process from a relatively short list of diagnoses that causes widespread inadequate blood flow and the resultant consequences of that.
Yeah, interesting. And I suppose then we come to how you categorize different kinds of shock. When we were speaking earlier, we come at it from slightly different perspectives. You being an intensivist and my being a paramedic. Whereas I have always thought about shock as distributive, obstructive, cardiogenic, and hypovolemic. Distributive shock being that the blood's road, the path that the blood takes to do its job, is too wide and too messy. Obstructive, that the path the blood takes is obstructed. Cardiogenic, where the pump is doing an insufficient job to have the blood do its work. And hypovolemic, where there is not enough blood for the work. And I often simplify that further to a pump problem, a fluid problem, and a pipe problem. Either the pump is not doing its job, there's insufficient fluid, or the pipes are buggered. But David, you think about it slightly differently.
Just slightly. And I guess the way I like to think about it has a more physiological basis. But I think it's important to note that all classification systems for shock are broadly similar. I'm very simple. So I kind of basically take that your last approach and use bigger words. So I think of whenever I approach a shocked patient or a patient in PEA cardiac arrest, because those are two conditions on a continuum, I think of preload, contractility, and afterload. So, you know, is there some condition that's decreased preload, such as hypovolemia, or increased intrathoracic pressure, such as a tension pneumothorax, or a tamponade affecting venous return? Is there some condition that's affected contractility, like cardiogenic shock? Or is there some condition that's affected afterload, such as sepsis or anaphylaxis or neurogenic shock? And that's just, you know, every shocked patient I approach, that will be the things that I quickly go through my mind at the bed space. But importantly, and as we're about to go on to, in the initial phases of managing shock, and I think this has been the big paradigm shift in recent years, the diagnosis doesn't matter as much as long as you go on and start managing the physiological derangement quickly while thinking about what the diagnosis might be and providing a specific management.
Yeah, interesting. So superficially, the way we think about it is quite different, but fundamentally very, very similar. Interesting.
I think so. I think the one, and we'll go on to this, probably, you know, anaphylaxis aside, which is its own special diagnosis and classification, which is associated with relatively stereotypical findings, where early adrenaline is definitely life-saving. But all other causes of shock, I must say, again, being a simple person, my approach is broadly similar until I figure out the diagnosis, if I figure out the diagnosis, and apply some more targeted management.
So that takes us nicely to the first steps outlined in the guideline, and that's fluid resuscitation, a controversial area, especially in sepsis. And before we moved on, we were talking earlier about history and mentioning the cholera epidemic, and it reminded me of one of the most beautiful pieces of writing I've ever seen in relation to fluid resuscitation. It was one of the earliest descriptions of fluid resuscitation in the medical literature from Thomas Latter. Still persevering, I thought she began to breathe less laboriously. Soon the sharpened features and sunken eyes and fallen jaw, pale and cold, bearing the manifest impress of death's signet, began to glow with returning animation. The pulse, which had long ceased, returned to the wrist. We don't write like that anymore, do we?
We definitely don't. That's a beautiful description of hypovolemic shock. And yeah, I wish medical journals were still written like that.
So, fluid, how much and to whom?
Well, I'm going to do a bit of history in this episode. I'm going to quote an unnamed but very famous Sydney intensivist, one of the fathers of intensive care medicine, who one evening in the ICU of a Sydney hospital that shall remain unnamed was approached by a young registrar and asked, what fluid should I give and how much? And this intensivist turned around and said, "You can give sterile dog piss for all I care, just do it carefully." And that exact phrase has been instilled into generations of intensivists in Australia and New Zealand, and I'm sure further afield. I guess, you know, the three questions are: who should we give fluid to, how much should we give, and what fluid should we use? Who should we give fluid to? I mean, probably everyone with shock, even you know, anaphylaxis, even though adrenaline comes much earlier in the algorithm. Anyone with any modality of shock will benefit from some fluid. Even people with cardiogenic shock will improve with a bit of fluid. You just have to be super careful. But in general, fluid is usually the first step in managing someone with shock, although less important in paramedicine, but certainly in hospital practice, something that we always drum into junior doctors is that you don't give a bag of fluid and walk away, because it's almost always a temporizing measure to give you time to think about what else might be going on. How much fluid? The brief answer to that is a lot less than we used to give. Back in the late 90s, when I started working in pre-hospital care, our ambulances, I think they contained something like 6 liters of saline and several bottles of Hemocell, which was a colloid fluid, which we might go on to talk about. And it was not uncommon to hear, you know, calling for backup for more fluid, despite an enormous amount of fluid already being available. That just doesn't happen anymore. We now have quite good evidence to show that fluid overload creates complications in and of itself. The condition of ARDS, the, you know, respiratory distress syndrome that we often see in ICU, some people would refer to as end-stage fluid overload. It's a consequence of giving too much fluid. And so most algorithms now have a much earlier progression to vasopressors in addition to fluids. Which fluid to give? Look, I would like to say it probably doesn't matter. There's been large studies looking at this exact question. And in particular, I guess there's two questions to ask: crystalloid versus colloid, and in crystalloids, balanced salt solutions versus normal saline. I think, and some people may write in and complain about this, I think the crystalloid colloid debate is settled by and large. There is, other than in patients with sepsis specifically, and in patients with traumatic brain injury, for most patients, there's no evidence that colloid is better than crystalloid. The old mantra that colloids, so starch-containing or protein-containing fluids, are you need to give less and they hang around in the circulation for longer, that's not true. So I remember being taught at medical school that, you know, 1 liter of colloid equals 3 liters of crystalloid. We now have quite good data to show that it's actually about a ratio of 1 to 1.3. So there's not much difference. There is some data to suggest that patients with sepsis may do better with albumin as a colloid. albumin is a very impractical fluid to use in the pre-hospital setting. So it has to be kept in a glass bottle. It's a fractionated blood product. There's a whole number of reasons why I don't ever think that will be a practical pre-hospital fluid. There's also evidence that patients with traumatic brain injury do worse when resuscitated with albumin. So with that in mind, particularly the practicalities of using probably the only useful colloid, it means crystalloids will be the resuscitation fluids we use in the pre-hospital environment. Is balanced salt solution like Hartmann's or Plasmolite better than normal saline? Possibly, actually. So there's some recent evidence to suggest that, again, in patients with sepsis, there may be benefit to using a balanced salt solution over crystalloid. So if you're the person buying fluids for your ambulance service, you know, that might be something that you might think about doing. There's always going to be a debate about whether the lower sodium levels in balanced salt solutions could potentially be harmful for patients with a traumatic brain injury. We may never know the answer to that question. So again, I mean, it probably doesn't matter. We use normal saline. We're having conversations as we speak about whether we should switch to Plasmolite or Hartmann's. But I imagine, you know, for the vast majority of patients, a crystalloid of your choice, titrated carefully to effect without giving too much, is perfectly adequate.
What is too much? What does it look like? And who is at risk of too much?
I think everyone's at risk of too much, but acutely, the patients who will get worse in front of you are those who have cardiogenic shock or those who have heart failure, so have impaired cardiac function and have shock for some other reason. And in those patients, even 250 ml boluses would be appropriate and probably no more than 500 ml to a litre in the pre-hospital phase before moving on to vasopressors. And this is simply because their heart is unable to cope with the increased preload that's being delivered quickly. Over time, all patients who receive too much intravenous fluid will become edematous, they'll get peripheral edema, they'll get pulmonary edema, they could even progress on to, you know, more serious conditions like ARDS. Probably the most common single drug used in an intensive care unit after the sedatives and vasopressors that our patients are on as infusions is furosemide. It is probably the drug that I would prescribe the most because almost every patient who's come into ICU critically ill, not necessarily that they've had too much fluid, but by the time they're in the maintenance or the recovery phase of their critical illness, we now have to start getting rid of all that fluid to aid with their recovery. And certainly over my career, patients have been less and less edematous as they get to ICU because of this change in practice in fluid management. I guess just one other thing to mention, and this is maybe thinking about the future. There was a very famous landmark study that came out about a decade ago showing that children with shock in sub-Saharan Africa actually had a worse outcome with fluid boluses than without. And this has alarmed and puzzled a lot of clinicians and researchers. And there's been chatter for a long time about replicating this study. Should we repeat it in adults? Is it relevant outside of the low and middle income country setting? But one of the plausible, you know, biological considerations of this observation in this study is that perhaps giving someone a rapid bolus of fluid is physiologically, you know, unsettling for them. And that kind of makes sense. If you're, you know, your body's struggling to achieve homeostasis in their shocked state, and then all of a sudden here arrives, you know, a liter of fluid banged in over 10 minutes, it's not unreasonable to think that that may have widespread effects throughout the body. And so that's certainly an area of research that's ongoing.
So those are the patients who are at risk of overload. What about the patients who, where things have gone much better? What does an adequate response look like after a fluid bolus?
Well, I think you've already described it in your description from latter of the patient getting better from cholera. The heart rate will come down, the blood pressure will go up, they may warm up peripherally. The important thing is, in some patients, this will be a lasting response. In some patients, this will be a temporary response. And this is what we have to be alert for, as to whether this patient, and we talk about whether patients are fluid responsive or not. But yeah, certainly the shocked state will, if your fluid bolus works, will resolve, but that resolution of the shock state may be temporary.
Is there a way to tell who will respond well and who won't?
I'm sure there is, and I'm sure there's a Nobel Prize for whoever finds out. Look, there's a lot of work ongoing, and a lot of people talk about various different techniques to try and figure out who will or won't respond to fluid before giving them a fluid bolus. And you may have heard of techniques like a passive leg raise. You may have heard of people using point of care ultrasound to look at the size of the inferior vena cava. There's a variety of different techniques that are described, and certainly some of them do have some utility, and these may be areas that we start looking into. You know, I think a small fluid bolus in most patients is unlikely to do a great deal of harm, and that may well be the best test. But it's not outside the realms of possibility that we think about other tests that we may introduce in the near future.
What about raising the legs?
Yeah, so I think a passive leg raise, there is certainly some evidence to suggest that raising the legs above, you know, the kind of Trendelenburg position gives a transient 500 mil fluid bolus, and that you could assess, you know, if you're able to measure IVC collapsibility or cardiac output with an ultrasound machine, or even just look at the patient's blood pressure when this happens, that may be something that you could consider doing. I must admit, I'm not a passive leg raiser, not because I don't believe in the science, but just because the way I practice, I must say I usually just give a fluid bolus and see what happens, rightly or wrongly. But certainly, you know, I am aware that people do passive leg raises as part of their assessment of shock.
So the next step in the AAV guideline is to move on to metaraminol if the patient inadequately responds or is profoundly sick in the first place. Can you tell us a little bit more about that decision to move on versus to stick with fluid?
Sure. I might just take it back a step, particularly for any international listeners that we might have, because we know we have a couple. Metaraminol is a push dose or a bolus dose vasopressor. It is a pure indirect alpha agonist, and it is widespread use in anaesthetic and critical care practice in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. It's probably not very well known or used outside of those three settings. So a lot of places would be more familiar with phenylephrine, which is another pure alpha agonist. And some places may even use dilute 10 micrograms per mil adrenaline as their push dose vasopressor. So the idea of it is a drug that you drop in a syringe, you give a bolus of 1 to 2 mils at a time, so 0.5 to 1 milligram of metaraminol in a standard concentration. And that results in a vasoconstriction and can temporarily raise the blood pressure. And so the idea of it, or the way that most people would use it, is a patient has had a fluid bolus and hasn't responded appropriately, or they're warm and vasodilated peripherally, so you suspect that you're dealing with a vasoplegic or a distributive type of shock, usually septic shock. In addition to ongoing fluid, you can start to give small boluses of a vasopressor while arranging for a more durable vasopressor by infusion. It's also commonly used in anesthesia or in other areas in the emergency department, the intensive care unit, the pre-hospital environment, where we're inducing anesthesia, because most of the drugs we use to induce anesthesia are vasodilators. So it's used to reverse the temporary vasodilation that is predictable from anesthetic induction agents. There'll also be patients where you arrive and they look incredibly unwell and the first blood pressure is 60 or 60 systolic, where you get IV access and by all means start giving a fluid bolus, but in a patient who's so critically unwell, who's on the pathway towards cardiac arrest, it would be very reasonable to start using a bolus dose vasopressor up front, almost regardless of the etiology of the shock, just to buy you some time and possibly prevent a cardiac arrest in that patient.
Is there any evidence for any particular vasopressor?
Not really, no. And this is another area, particularly in the septic shock field, that a lot of work has gone into. Most places would use, and worldwide I think this is the case, most places would use noradrenaline or norepinephrine for North Americans as the vasopressor of choice for ongoing infusion. There have been trials looking at comparing noradrenaline with dopamine, comparing noradrenaline with adrenaline. and haven't really shown any benefit. So for most patients, it's likely that it probably doesn't matter. And in a situation where physiology or pathophysiology isn't as important, what becomes more important is geography and staff familiarity with that drug. And that's part of the reason why we've chosen to introduce noradrenaline to intensive care paramedic practice in Victoria, because it's the drug that most in-hospital staff would be familiar with as a vasopressor, which is given by infusion.
That's interesting. That segues nicely into my next question. Prior to the introduction of this guideline, our only vasopressor was adrenaline. Was there a particular reason why we introduced metaraminol and noradrenaline?
Yeah, I think it was broadly to bring our practice, I don't want to say bring our practice into line, but to ensure our practice was as consistent as possible with in-hospital practice, allowing, of course, for the intricacies and, you know, important differences of pre-hospital practice. You know, adrenaline is a very effective vasopressor, but it's also an inotrope, and it has its own side effects ranging from trivial, such as tremor and anxiety in a conscious patient. It elevates the lactate, which can end up being a confounder. So it's not really the ideal drug for most patients with most types of shock.
Next in the guideline, we ask paramedics to move on to noradrenaline if a couple of doses of metaraminol doesn't achieve the desired results, or if the desired results aren't sustained. And we give that through a peripheral IV. This is something we've done for quite a while in ambulance, but I noticed that there is still some debate about its safety. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I think there's probably not as much debate as there used to be, but you're absolutely right. It has been something that's been incredibly controversial. And this has actually been one of the biggest developments, I think, in the management of shock outside of the ICU setting in my career so far, is the widespread acceptability and really understanding of the safety of peripheral vasopressor use. You know, it's one of these things. We often find ourselves in this situation in medicine where we know that there's something that rarely causes something bad. So if you give noradrenaline via a peripheral line, every now and then the peripheral IV line will tissue. You'll end up infiltrating some noradrenaline, which is a powerful vasoconstrictor, into the subcutaneous tissues, and you can cause tissue necrosis. And that can be bad, and that can cause tissue loss and you know, have a very serious impact for the patient, even though it's very rare. So for a long time, people said, oh, you should never run noradrenaline through a peripheral line. But what often people don't do is then take the next step and think, well, hang on, if I don't run a vasopressor through a peripheral line, what I'm left with is a profoundly shocked patient who's getting bucket loads of fluid that's doing them harm, who's waiting for someone who knows how to put in a central line to come along and put in a central line and then check its position with an X-ray and then start a central noradrenaline infusion. And people haven't thought that the actual harm of a patient having delayed treatment for their shock is far more significant likely than the potential harm of a noradrenaline drip extravasating and causing tissue necrosis. So that reckoning, in addition to, you know, the now widespread use of peripheral noradrenaline with relatively good data on its safety, you know, have convinced most people, myself included, that, you know, a decent sized cannula in the ACF with, you know, noradrenaline being infused into a running line is as safe as it can be for, you know, given the patient population that we're doing this for. I did mention, you know, a decent sized cannula in the ACF. This isn't a 22 gauge in the back of the hand that we're going to be running noradrenaline through. And if that was the only access, to be honest, my preference would be to run it through an intraosseous line if you couldn't get any other access rather than a dodgy cannula in the hand.
As you say, noradrenaline is relatively new for us and I think not commonly used in the pre-hospital or out-of-hospital environment. Are there any special tips or tricks, ways in which it might be different to adrenaline?
Yeah, there's one big one, and that is that you must not ever bolus noradrenaline. So when running an adrenaline infusion, it would be acceptable and normal in some circumstances to give a small bolus of adrenaline to if the patient were deteriorating. That is incredibly unpredictable with noradrenaline, and you may end up with a, you know, systolic blood pressure approaching 300, which may obviously be very harmful for the patient. Other than that, it's broadly similar. You know, so we would drop noradrenaline in a relatively standard concentration. It's administered in a dose depending on where you are, based on geography. So it's important to be familiar with the terminology and the concentrations that are used in your local area. In Victoria, we tend to refer to noradrenaline doses in micrograms per minute. You know, similar to adrenaline, a low dose would be, you know, probably below 5, below 10. We'd often refer to single digit noradrenaline or low dose noradrenaline as being in that range. You know, a moderate dose from 10 to 20 or 25, and doses above 25 to 30 micrograms per minute, similar to adrenaline, would be considered a high dose and a trigger to move on to the next step.
But when you reach that ceiling, what is the next step?
Yeah, well, this is another area where we've, I guess, modified what had been the normal practice pre-hospital here in Victoria to model or reflect what happens in hospital. And in most situations, the next step when someone's on a high dose of noradrenaline is to add adrenaline as a second vasopressor with some inotropic activity. In hospital, we also have the option of adding vasopressin, which we would normally do, but we've thought this through and decided that, you know, vasopressin probably isn't a useful drug for us to use in the pre-hospital setting because it only has that one indication as being a secondary vasopressor, whereas adrenaline will be perfectly sufficient for that role. And again, we would be titrating up the adrenaline in a similar manner to how we had titrated up the noradrenaline. And I think it's fair to say, you know, by the time you've got a patient on 30 of NORAD and 30 of adrenaline, you're dealing with an incredibly sick patient.
Finally, at the bottom of the guideline, it asks paramedics to consult with the AV medical advisor on call, probably yourself, if none of the above has worked. We've had some feedback expressing concern that that's taking autonomy away from paramedics, but more and more we're having conversations about sharing decisions, about consulting with our colleagues. Could you speak to that a little?
Yeah, I think this is a really important part of the development of paramedicine as a profession, and I absolutely don't see it as taking autonomy away, and I'll describe why. If I'm in the ICU and I have a patient who's on 30 of NORAD and 30 of adrenaline, I will be finding a colleague and bringing them to the bedside and saying, what am I missing? Is there anything I should be doing differently? What do you reckon we should do next? And that's not because I'm a bad doctor. It's just because I know that I'm now dealing with a very sick patient, and that patient deserves to have as many experts as possible contributing to the decision-making about their care. And so, you know, a consult with a physician or with a more senior paramedic or with whoever happens to be operating the consult line in your ambulance service is usually just a sharing of, you know, what have you done? What would you do differently? What might you have missed? What you know, I've encountered this situation before. This is what I did. So I don't think this is anything that people need to be afraid of or worried about in terms of autonomy. You know, 9 times out of 10, the advice from the medical director might be just keep increasing them, keep increasing the drugs or give some more fluid, or, you know, when we have point of care ultrasound, you know, just make sure there's no tension pneumothorax or something like that. Likely things that have already been done. But in the modern team-based approach to healthcare, not really the kind of decision-making that should be made by a single practitioner in the back of an ambulance dealing with a critically ill patient.
When I started in ambulance, I felt that way because I was told that if I didn't know something like this, I couldn't figure it out myself, I couldn't stand on my own 2 legs, it meant I was a bad paramedic. I think that culture is common in pre-hospital services all over the world. That's my sense anyway. And this wasn't that long ago. I didn't start that long ago. And that's a culture that has to change. We've made a lot of progress, but we've still got a long way to go, I think. And the introduction of the medical advisor on call is a really positive step towards a team-based approach to looking after our patients. So that's our approach to shock here at Ambulance Victoria. David, what about the future? What's still to come?
Look, I think there's quite a few things that are likely to be coming in the future. The most immediate thing that will be coming relatively soon is that we'll be conducting a randomized controlled trial of adrenaline versus noradrenaline for patients with cardiogenic shock. So cardiogenic shock is a subtype of shock where there's always been a relatively early recourse to an inotrope for pretty obvious physiological reasons. But there's emerging data to suggest that perhaps these patients may do better with a pure vasopressor rather than an inotrope. So we're, Ambulance Victoria, are teaming up with our colleagues, Alfred Health, one of the cardiology fellows there's PhD project is leading this randomized controlled trial. So that'll be quite exciting. That's coming in the not too distant future. Given that we've been quite pleased with the kind of simplicity and the feedback we've had from this guideline, we've looked at how we might adopt similar guidelines for trauma patients. Now, this is an entirely different cohort of patients, the shocked trauma patient from the septic shock patient. And there's always, I think it's fair to say, there has always been a very understandable reluctance to have an early recourse to vasopressors in the shock trauma patient, purely because the patients are usually maximally vasoconstricted in the early phase anyway, and giving a vasopressor may lull clinicians into a false sense of security when what the patient really needs is an operation or interventional radiology procedure to stop their bleeding and some fluid, usually in the form of blood or blood product, to give them a reasonable perfusion to their brain until that happens. Having said that, anyone who's worked in trauma ICU or in trauma medicine knows that eventually patients will end up with a degree of vasodilation as well as part of the inflammatory state that's associated with multiple injuries. And so there's an increasing degree of comfort in using judicious doses of vasopressors to ensure adequate cerebral perfusion in patients with traumatic shock. And so that's something we're working together with the trauma services in Victoria to clarify our processes there. And I guess the big thing, and really one of the big game changers that's in the process of being rolled out into paramedic practice across the world, is the use of point of care ultrasound, which is really an ideal tool to help diagnose more effectively the underlying cause of shock, and in a skilled practitioner's hands, potentially assess the response to treatment as well. So with point of care ultrasound, you can, very effectively diagnose or rule out tension pneumothorax. You can see if there's free fluid in the abdomen. So if in a trauma patient, whether there's intra-abdominal bleeding, and once you know what you're doing, you can have some degree of comfort in looking at heart function or fluid around the heart in a tamponade setting. And also you can gain IV access more easily to shut down shock patients. So this is, this is going to be a game changer for paramedic practice, and something that I'm very happy to say is hopefully is coming to Victorian paramedic practice very soon.
Well, thanks, David. It's been a really interesting journey through history and a really interesting overview of our approach to shock here at Ambulance Victoria. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Oh, happy to talk about shock anytime, and it's so good to be back in the studio doing these again, and looking forward to what's coming up next. And please remember to send in any suggestions you might have for future episodes.